Welcome again to the Townsville Feminist Stories podcast series. My name is Chantal Oxenham, and I am a member of the Townsville Feminist Collective. In this podcast, the number 3 in the series, I am talking to former Queensland Senator Margaret Reynolds. Arriving in Townsville in 1965, Margaret was a teacher who worked with children with special needs and also had a particular interest in Indigenous education. At the same time, she became involved in feminist and peace issues and eventually turned her attention to local politics. Margaret was elected to the Townsville City Council in 1979 and served for 4 years before becoming a federal Labor senator representing Queensland, a role she filled with dedication and distinction until 1999. She now lives in Tasmania and, never one to sit idly by, is currently national president of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. So, Margaret, you came to Townsville in 1965, a time where Townsville was a very different place from what it is today. What were your experiences of feminism here in those early years?
Well, of course, I discovered that Townsville was just something I had never experienced. I grew up in quiet little Tasmania, and then we'd lived in London for a couple of years. And I really probably was not quite a feminist when I arrived. I think I was learning how to be, but Townsville can take credit for awakening me to what was wrong with the world, and that's how I became a feminist. Townsville was a very sexist and racist place. It was very conservative and conventional, and women were expected to know their place, stay in the background, and above all, look after the house and their husbands, because they were all husbands in those days, and not get involved in politics. That was just unthinkable.
Yes, I read in one of the of your books, I think, that you were involved with Well. In fact, you helped establish Well. So, how did it come about in Townsville?
Well, Women's Electoral Lobby was seen as a particularly radical women's organisation. I had actually joined the more conservative National Council of Women before I even had heard of Women's Electoral Lobby in Southern Australia. Yeah. But it was because I was very interested in politics and trying to change at least part of my world. I was very keen to get Women's Electoral Lobby started in Townsville. I was politicised by Australia becoming so involved in Vietnam, and particularly conscripting young men to be sent to an overseas war. I started Save Our Sons as a young mother myself with about a one-year-old son at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was introduced to the media through that activity, because no one had ever heard of a young woman daring to talk about foreign policy in those days.
Yes.
And saying that she was doing it because she was worried about her son, who was then only a baby. And I mean, it really was a bit impertinent of me, I suppose. But I mean, it was quite personal to me. I just thought, goodness, you know, I can't imagine someone just coming along and saying that baby John, grown up, should go off to overseas to war because a government said so. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty naive young thing. But circumstances led me to become much more aware of the world and my world, my place in it, through day-to-day experiences in Townsville.
Yes, of course, yes. And so in the late 70s, you were elected to local council, one of only a handful of women to take up such positions. So how did that go, and what do you think you were able to achieve for women in Townsville?
Well, look, I'd got involved in local politics because there were so many issues that affected women at the local level, as there always will be, but certainly in those days. And it was really being left behind in the hot sun by one of the rare suburban buses, because I had a pram, that really motivated me to get involved and find out more about this thing called local government. And I started to ask women to come and help me monitor what was going on at the local council, because they met at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And Jonas Reed was there, and she was very welcoming. No one else was, of course, but we used to take our children, because 4 o'clock is not a good time for children, especially very young ones. So we'd take children with their toys and snacks and babies with bottles, and sit in the public gallery. And it was quite unusual for such a thing to happen anywhere in Australia in those days, and let alone Townsville. But out of that, I went to the council on behalf of a group of women, many of whom became Women's Electoral Lobby, and we asked for a women's advisory committee to council. Of course, we didn't get it. We didn't get it. They said, oh no, there was no need for such a thing. And so I ran for local government instead. And when I got, of course, there were two other women there, and we tried to work on, a range of issues affecting women, issues like in those days, women's health, issues around children, issues around community support for people in need. And it was very hard because it was so difficult to steer the council agenda away from the tradition of roads, rates and rubbish. But eventually, after about 12 months, I became the chair of a committee called the Community and Cultural Development Committee, and we did take on some welfare and housing initiatives. And it was also in that period that the art gallery was established, the civic theatre had been established, but we promoted a range of different performances to come from the south to North Queensland, and of course, Dance North. So for that era, it was pretty revolutionary for a local council to be involved. And I would say it was partly because of three women on council, but also we had some good young men on council, particularly Mike Reynolds. And he assisted us. He'd worked with Jonas Reed earlier to us being elected. And so we were known as a pretty progressive local council, not just in Queensland, but anywhere in the country. And we were quite a young council for those days. I mean, we'd got rid of all the old men in a previous election, and we had, yes, we were led by a couple of older men, but the younger ones amongst us were able to introduce some new ideas, and gradually, of course, the Townsville City Council became known for its innovation.
Yes, that's right. Yes, and yes, you're quite right with some of the changes that happened back then. Yes, And it's good to see that Dance North is still a very well-known dance company who's winning prizes across the world. Mm-hmm. And, of course, mm-hmm. we have the Per Stacker Gallery getting all mm-hmm. these incredible exhibitions. So that's very mm-hmm. good. Yes, yeah. So, Margaret, then made the move to the Senate, where you served for 16 years. So how were you treated in Parliament as a woman and as a loud, proud feminist?
Well, look, interestingly, those few of us, because there were only a few of us elected in 83 and then a few more in 84, and so it continued during my 16 years that the numbers gradually started to increase. But while there were still relatively few of us in the parliament, I'd say we were patronised, but we were also ignored. We just weren't very important. I mean, oh, so a few women have come to parliament. Oh, well, they won't do much harm. You know, we can just afford to ignore them. Mm-hmm. But of course, in reality, what was infuriating about being patronised and indeed ignored on some occasions, but in reality, it actually assisted us to establish a structure for working. And in on my side of politics, we had the Caucus Status of Women Committee. We had our first woman cabinet minister, Susan Ryan. And so Susan relied on the small Caucus Status of Women Committee to develop sex discrimination legislation, affirmative action legislation. And gradually, when I took her position, I was responsible for getting through what was known as the National Agenda for Women, yes. which was as a result of nationwide communication and consultations with women around cities and towns and rural areas. And through that process, it was required for all cabinet documents to actually indicate how the policy proposed, whatever it happened to be, would impact on women. Mm-hmm. Now, it hasn't survived, I'm sorry to say, but it was quite extraordinary in my day because I was seen as being not in cabinet, but I was a minister who was frequently called to cabinet because of this policy that all issues had to be debated for their impact on women. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't win all the time, I'm sorry to say, but it was the start of a new process for Australian policy developers that they had to consider more than 50% of the population, mm-hmm. Which had been ignored for generations. So mm-hmm. that was a very exciting time to be in Parliament, and for all the frustrations of trying to work within the ministry, which I had for 3 years, it was a very worthwhile experience because you knew you were contributing to a very exciting period of policy history.
Yes. So to take that a bit further, in your maiden speech to the Senate in 1983, you voiced your commitment to feminism, Aboriginal land rights and social equity. Do you feel that you were able to advance these issues during your time in politics? Some other examples, perhaps?
Sure. Well, look, anyone who's been in politics likes to claim that they've made a difference. So I don't want to overemphasize my own personal contribution. But there were some areas where I was in a position to make considerable change. For instance, I noticed that just recently there was a national domestic violence campaign launched, and the Prime Minister said, oh yes, it was the first that ever been. Well, no, Prime Minister, read your history. We first launched a national domestic violence campaign in 1988. And that was, that was absolute landmark in terms of tackling what remains, the high levels of violence against women in this country. There were other initiatives too that we developed Aboriginal women's policies for non-English speaking background women. We worked with to try to change media, the way in which the media portrayed women in so many ways in those days. So there was a lot within the gender policy agenda that I personally feel, with a lot of other women, both in the bureaucracy and of course in the community, as well as some of my colleagues, we were able to make a difference, and some of it has remained, though sadly not all, and many young women are still having to reinvent the wheel in asserting the primacy of women in our society. In terms of Indigenous rights, I was able to go straight into an Aboriginal policy committee at the time of land rights debate. And at that time, I frequently asked for a briefing on the Mabo High Court decision. And of course, at that time, not the decision, just the case actually, because we knew, or I knew very well, that our friend Eddie Mabo was taking his land rights claim to the High Court. But could I get a briefing on it in Canberra, just across from the High Court itself? Nobody wanted to know. And it was just assumed that this strange woman from North Queensland was talking idealistic nonsense, and I said it was patronising, and that whatever it was I was on about would never, never, never come about. Well, of course it did, and so not only did the High Court rule in Mabo's favour, but subsequently, there is a great deal of native title recognition across North Australia, and it's all because of Eddie Mabo's case. There were other areas where I took Indigenous issues, as I took women's issues, into the international arena, because it was around the time leading to the Beijing Conference for Women, and there was a lot of emphasis on starting to reform the way in which women were treated, and area so many areas of discrimination, whichever country you considered. So yes, I think I can quite honestly say that maybe I was just the right person in the right place at the right time, but certainly I was able to have the satisfaction of actually achieving recognition of much of the work that needed to be done in ending discrimination, or starting to end discrimination against women and Indigenous peoples.
Yes, thank you, Margaret, for that. Yes, for these very significant events and examples that you are able to share with us. Yes. And so, Margaret, is there life after politics? What are you involved with now?
Well, it's interesting. When I left politics, I left of my choosing, which is rare for many people who decide to go into our parliaments, because most people either lose at the ballot box or lose at pre-selection. And I'd had my share of problems with pre-selection, but I was able to leave at the time of my choosing. And I left not to spend more time with my family. Much as my family is very important to me, I refuse to say that, because that's what all the men say. They say, "Oh, we're leaving to spend more time with our families." And of course, they never do. They go off and make money or play more golf or whatever. But I did want to move on to do something else. And I did want to keep a focus on the international community because I'd been fortunate in being involved with a number of United Nations initiatives, Commonwealth Human Rights Initiative. I was chair of that for several years, and Parliamentarians for Global Action. So I knew there was a lot of work still to be done in that international field, and that's where I wanted to focus. But at the local level, because I knew I wasn't going to be doing that full time, I really wanted to try to convey all I had learnt about our system of democracy and how to try to make it work in the best interests of our community. Because as soon as you leave Parliament, you realise how irrelevant it is to most people. And even people you expect to have some understanding. I mean, I went straight from Parliament to lecturing at the University of Queensland. But even there, among many of my colleagues, even in a department focused on politics and international relations, they really were quite dismissive of politics in the real parliament, just as politicians are dismissive of the work that academics are doing in the universities. So this also interested me in how can we get a better understanding between, those experts in our universities who know so much and research in great detail so many areas that are relevant to our community, and yet they are disregarded by so many politicians, just as academics return the favour by dismissing so many parliamentarians. And frankly, I can see why it happens, but we've got to try to break that down. Because if you look, for example, at our current situation internationally, some of the statements from the Prime Minister to the opposition leader to the Foreign Minister and many others, I mean, they are such small-minded, narrow, irrelevant commentary to just keep everyone happy or keep Australians safe. And we should be able to have a proper debate about how Australia as a middle power fits into this chaotic world that we have at the moment with a total breakdown in international humanitarian law. But we can't because our politicians dare not speak about it because they think the public is disinterested. But of course, when they see some of the rallies and marches around the country, they realize that yes, they are interested, but they perhaps are, they regard them as more of a worry than the demonstrating the need for them to be more proactive themselves.
Yes. So, Margaret, really, your contributions adds another dimension to our podcast series. So, thank you very much for that. Congratulations on all your achievements. And who knows, we might speak again in the future. Thank you, Margaret.